The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Call them the Bonnie and Clyde of Jihad. Syed Rizwan Farooq and Tashfeen Malik, a married couple. They did not rob banks, but the arsenal they amassed, according to the FBI, was enough to sustain a terrorist rampage for months. The FBI is suspecting terrorism in this case, and the names of the 14 dead released fit the bill in the sense that they were just innocent county government workers in San Bernardino gunned down during a Christmas party by two radicalized armed terrorists.
These people, they represent themselves, and they're really true criminals, and they're all over the world, not only in America.
One of the neighbors of the shooters describing the people they live down the street from. Yesterday, San Bernardino Police Chief Jared Burgoyne gave reporters a quick tally of just how prepared Farooq and Malik were.
On their person, on their body, and in the vehicle, they had over 1,400 223 caliber rounds that were available to them, and they had over 209 millimeter rounds on their persons as well.
Is there some kind of sickness associated with that sort of home arsenal, collected mostly legally, as far as we know? Gary Slutkin is a former epidemiologist for the World Health Organization and the founder and executive director of Cure Violence. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So generalize your sense of violence as fitting the pattern of a communicable disease on some level. And can you fit this case into the model that you use to evaluate violence in other places, particularly the inner city?
We look at violence as a contagious disease. It fits the characteristics of a disease, and then it has very characteristic signs and symptoms causing death and or disability. And it's contagious, that is to say, each event seems to lead to more events. Our direct work on this, using this, includes using outreach workers and interrupters who are health workers, the same way that we use health workers for other contagious processes that we see in communities, to detect unusual events or more, in some cases, usual events, and to prevent them from happening and preventing the spread. And our experience of this, which has been in U.S. cities and in Latin America and South Africa and even in southern Iraq, shows that we can get between 40 and 70% drops in events.
So if we were to look at this as a public health issue, you would be tracking the amassing of weapons. You would basically track people buying a huge number of bullets and rounds and various handguns and try to figure out what the personal public health dimension of those purchases are and interrupt at that point. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's an interesting way that you're asking that, actually, because I mean, ordinarily the situation that Cure Violence is working in the U.S. cities, in New York, in Baltimore, in Chicago, and Oakland, New Orleans, these places, the weapons are everywhere and very easy to access when people want them. So really, we're more looking for events that might happen, thinking more in terms of the people and the situations and the circumstances, because we'd be going out of our mind actually trying to track the weapons. So we're looking for information from friends and family and the community. And people tell us very, very easily because they know that we're, working in everybody's interest. No, people do not have any reason to back off of health workers. And we find out, who was upset at the party last night, who slept with somebody's girlfriend, who was disrespected, who owes somebody money, and then, in the case of retaliations, who was in fact shot, and so then who might be thinking of shooting. And I mean, we're virtually 100% effective at preventing retaliations, and like I said, very commonly can make a neighborhood 40-50% safer in a period of just a few months. And some neighborhoods, like in Baltimore, have gone a year and a half without shootings and killings using this approach.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the reactions that have come out. There's a New York sheriff who urges gun owners to carry their firearms and actually issued a warning saying that, people who have legal permits should carry them, almost as though if you see something, shoot something. That's sort of the idea. Ulster County, New York, licensed gun owners are urged to carry a firearm, to responsibly take advantage of your legal right to carry a firearm in case of incidents like the San Bernardino shooting. Now, does that transmit the virus, for lack of a better word, of violence to have people doing that on the street, or is it a preventive violence prevention tool?
I mean, using basically the science and the data, I mean, this is something that would be expected to make things worse. I mean, we understand it as both an emotional response and something that allows some people to feel a little more protected, but this is the kind of thing that makes things worse because more events will occur.
So this is a transmission notion of violence here to urge people to carry guns. Let's talk about coping with the radicalization piece. It seems to me that if you're going to really have an impact on the community trying to be more vigilant about these sorts of shootings and using the information that's come out in San Bernardino and to some extent in Sandy Hook a few years ago, the only thing that's going to work, as far as I can tell, and this sounds grim, but is to desanitize the effects of this, that people need to see what that, you know, room looked like after those people were in there. People need to really see in the same way that, you know, people saw Emmett Till's face and suddenly there was a transformed view of violence associated with race in the United States and things began to change. It seems to me that's the only cure for something like this if you want to mobilize citizens.
Well, so there's two parts to this. I mean, what is it that makes for an additional response? You know, the shock as if there hasn't been enough. But really, then it is the other part of what you're asking, which is, you know, what are the appropriate responses that are not emotional, but that are likely to be effective? So there is a missing piece here, which is that there really aren't assigned health workers whose job it is primarily to find likely cases who are either thinking about something now or thinking about who might be earlier on in their evolution towards thinking about something weeks now or months down. Because, of course, there's for any event that's happening, there's others who are thinking about it. Just like for every case of TB, there's someone who is brewing it, you know, who is a few months or weeks away from it activating. And then further on, you know, earlier on in the stream, there's people who have earlier subclinical cases. So when you put a health worker network into place for something like this, which is kind of in the community, has the job of looking for potential cases, you do a lot of good beyond just the finding what's going to happen tomorrow or the next week. But you start to pull people away from being nearer than they are to the line. In other words, we're pulling people back from the likelihood of doing it because we're also talking with people, as we are in neighborhoods and cities in the U.S., we're pulling them further back from the idea that they would do a shooting.
Okay, so that addresses directly the idea of radicalization, getting some sort of network of health workers to observe the patterns of acquisition of weapons, to think about things that are happening in the neighborhood that might produce violence, and trying to intervene and figure out ways of intervening in advance. Now, would you say that the main impediment to installing a network like that for all kinds of violence in the United States is the NRA that keeps Congress from even studying this as a public health matter?
No, I don't think that's it. I just think that they may be an impediment to some other aspects of this that have to do with making the firearms less available and accessible. But the part that I've been talking about right now, it really just is a missing piece, which is looking at this as a contagious disease process in the broader scope, and then quite specifically, you know, getting the health sector to be helpful in this. This isn't just a law enforcement issue. This is really a health issue. It's a behavior issue. It's a way of thinking and behaving that's contagious.
And we could start this tomorrow. We could do this tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, there needs to be the right people selected and the right people trained, and the training has to be exactly a certain way. This is what Cure Violence does. is it really knows how to select the right people who have access and trust, and then to train them in persuasion and cooling down and changing thinking and doing the behavior change and making it really click and staying with people. These are the things law enforcement, then they have the time to do, is really work with the populations in a trained way to help them change thinking. And we change thinking all the time, whether it's about smoking or eating or exercise or drunk driving or, I mean, sexual behavior. I mean, changing behavior and changing thinking is really the bread and butter of the health sector.
Gary Sletkin is a former epidemiologist for the World Health Organization and the founder and director of Cure Violence. Gary, it's great to have a discussion that doesn't require us to focus on the NRA and the political stalemate in Washington. These are things that could happen immediately if we begin thinking differently about violence. Gary, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It's a test of world governance and another way of responding to gun violence. Week one of the two-week UN Climate Summit in Paris has come to an end, with institutions and thousands of individuals pledging to stop spending on fossil fuels. There was the announcement this week of plans to boost clean energy in Africa, along with the announcement of $30 million from the United States to the countries most vulnerable to the effects of climate change. Among the most passionate participants at the summit are young people. The Ground Truth Project, headed by Charlie Sennett, co-founder of the Global Post, has been on the ground in Paris all week alongside a delegation of Ground Truth climate change fellows, six young international correspondents there to tell the biggest story of their generation. At partner station WGBH, Charlie Sennett gave us a briefing on his time in Paris, along with Ground Truth fellows Justine Kalma and Chris Bentley, who stuck around Paris to soak up the energy.
On one level, there's this really kind of heartening enthusiasm from the younger generation and across generations for climate action. But on another level, I think a lot of people are skeptical, and I think rightly so, that there's going to be an agreement struck that lives up to all the rhetoric at the end of this. We won't know until the end of next week, but it's a pretty tall order that, you know, enthusiasm alone can't fill. So while that's really important, I think a lot of young people are very aware of the hard work that needs to be done.
Charlie Sennett, in your time in Paris, what did the city seem like responding to, of course, the terrible events of last month? And also thinking back to the many times Paris has been a place where people came together to try to seek peace or changes in the world.
The COP21 is really trying to say that this is about the next generation, but it's very interesting confluence of events in Paris that it also really is the same generation of youth that was attacked on November 13th in Paris. It's hard not to think that the Islamic State activists who took this thing on and these terrorists who wanted to do damage and divide people knew that and went after youth. So there's a sense of a determination of young people in and around La République to show resistance to this terrorism. And one of the ways of doing that we've seen sort of demonstrated live in the square at La République is to shift the focus to COP21, to the environment, and to put pressure on the world to come together, a counter-narrative away from the division and terrorism, and go toward coming together and really working together on what, you know, many would argue is a much greater global security threat, and that's climate change.
Justine, is it hard to keep in perspective the idea that terrorism, which seems so palpable and right around the corner, is perhaps not as urgent as the climate change issues that take a much longer time to develop as you talk with people at this conference?
I think everyone who's here at this conference understands what's at stake when we talk about climate change. And so there has been some change of narrative since the attacks happened. You know, people are saying that one of the things climate change has the potential of doing is making conflicts even worse, as, you know, as it further marginalizes people who are already vulnerable when different communities begin fighting for scarce resources. So I think it's only adding more fuel to the fire here.
And you represent the voice in some ways of some of the most vulnerable people in the world. Is there sympathy for the folks in the Philippines, your stomping ground?
Yeah, so I'm Filipino American. I was born in Manila, but I have grown up mostly in California. And it's, you know, I understand how the Philippines is impacted, and I understand how California is impacted as well. And there are quite a few delegates that I've met with here from the Philippines. I met a young woman who had walked from Manila to Tacloban, which was the worst hit area of Typhoon Haiyan. And then she joined the People's Pilgrimage and walked from Lyon to Paris and is here as an activist as well. And so I definitely am very excited to see these voices are being heard.
Chris Bentley, we've spoken with people who are worried that this ritualized sense of periodically talking about global warming and acquiring a sense of optimism just by, you know, shaking hands and discussing these issues really is in the backdrop of we're losing time, and we're already in a situation where we're going to have to be adapting to climate change. Do you see adaptation as the byword or prevention as the byword still on the floor of the conference there?
It has to be both, and they're so linked is the thing. Right now, we're talking about when you add up all the climate pledges that the various countries made in advance of the conference itself, we're talking about close to 3 degrees of warming, 3 degrees Celsius average global temperature rise, which is not only a lot, it's a lot more than the world agreed to do to keep it to several years ago. And even that is actually being called into question at this conference. There's a large group called the Climate Vulnerable Forum of the world's most vulnerable nations, those will stand to lose the most from climate change the quickest. And they want it actually to be 1.5 degrees Celsius. So that's about half what we're likely to get if the countries follow through with the pledges they came to the table with.
Well, Chris and Justine, thanks so much. Charlie, final thoughts?
Yeah, just to share one vignette, which is, you know, Chris and Justine have these great questions. It's hard for them to put them forward because they're surrounded by hundreds of establishment media, middle-aged folks like myself who are out there representing big news organizations that aren't asking these hard questions. Kevin Grant, who's the head of our group there, very much of this generation, tried to go to the Obama press conference, got into it, had his hand up the whole time. But I don't think many listeners understand that when the White House media press corps arrives at an event like this, all of the questions are pre-assigned, you know, to Associated Press, New York Times, CNN. Everyone knows what the questions are going to be. They're pre-selected. And there is sort of the fearless leader of this group, Kevin Grant, with his hand up with a crowdsourced question from all these young people about challenging President Obama, saying, if you're really listening to this generation, as you said you were in your speech here, why have you done so little in the environment in your administration? And when are we going to see an actual coordinated policy? And how can you say you're listening when, in fact, you know, we're not really seeing that? Beautiful question. And his hand was up the whole time, but he didn't get to ask it. So part of this is about the next generation finding its seat at the table and starting to ask those hard questions.
Charlie Sennert is co-founder of the Global Post and head of the Ground Truth Project based at WGBH. We spoke with him alongside Justine Kalma and Chris Bentley, two of the 6 Ground Truth Climate Fellows attending the conference in Paris. You can find a link to coverage from the Ground Truth Climate Fellows at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Hey, I know I want one. On my Christmas list this year, along with about a million other people, is one of those helicopter-looking robot drones. Have you seen them? The It toy this year perhaps skews a little older than Elmo and is starting to worry the FAA. In a moment, a member of Congress worries out loud about the proliferation of civilian drones this year. But first, a Takeaway exclusive. Drones are having an impact on the seasonal workforce. We take you now to the offices of Hot Wings Aviation in East Flemington, New Jersey.
Well, I just don't know if these shoes will work for me. I said that to him. And I said, I don't care if they are 40% off. They make my ankles look ugly. Oh, Tierra, honey, I gotta go. Yeah. Yeah, let's just say some really ugly ankles just walked in here. 4 of them, to be exact. All right, bye, honey. Welcome to Hot Wings Aviation. May I help? Oh, God, what is that smell?
Hi. Sorry, that's reindeer smell. Trust me, it is better in the Arctic tundra.
Oh, well, hello, Mr. Reindeer. Hey, watch where you're going.
Oh, my antlers.
Oh, my goodness. Can't you put them in some sort of a cute hat or something?
Sorry, no. Never had to worry about that sort of thing. I spent most of my time flying. That's why I'm here. I'm looking for work. Blitzen's the name, and this here is my partner. Say hello.
Prancer.
So what does that mean? You're a dancer or a flyer? I don't understand.
No, it's Prancer. That's my name, and I fly. I'm a flying reindeer. So's he. We're looking for some seasonal work.
Our regular gig has gone away.
We've been replaced. Downsized.
We're victims of automation.
Oh, that's terrible. Oh, who would fire two nice, tall...
Flying reindeer.
Right, exactly. Who would do such a thing?
It was the man with a beard who ditched us. Yeah, that Arctic blubberhead with a beard we've been hauling around ever since.
The beginning of time, it seems. And for a lifetime of service to Santa, we get...
Dumped for a bunch of drones.
Drones. These annoying little robot flyers have driven Santa drone crazy. If you were at the North Pole right now, you would not believe what was going on.
That's good. Put a few more boxes on. Look at that, elves. Load up those drones. We can ditch this old sleigh, finally.
We can program these drones right down to the street address for as many trips as you'd like, Santa.
We've done the math, Santa. 20 million drones, 2 trips each, 6 packages per trip.
Woohoo! No more filthy chimneys.
That should just about do it, Santa.
That's Christmas! And I can just hang out here next to the eggnog bowl all night.
But what about us?
Oh, right, reindeer. We'll have to think about that one. How about some extra reindeer chow? Would that make you happy?
Reindeer chow, nice.
You see what I mean? This drone thing is just not thought through. The implications.
I hear you, but Santa, he's got top clearance from the FAA. He can do whatever he wants.
Could we work for FedEx?
Oh, FedEx? No, they're union only.
How about Amazon?
Oh, come on, give me a break. You think they're not 10 steps ahead of Santa on the drone thing? You are way too low-tech for Jeff Bezos. Maybe you'd like some reindeer chow, though, huh? Little chow-chow?
Pass.
Here's the FAA's real problem with drones.
1982, Roger. Change to runway 13 right, clear to land. We got a report of a drone on a 1 mile final for the left side, 1,000 feet. We're trying to get the police helicopter in the area to see if we can find it.
Okay, we're transitioning over to 13 right. No problem, Southwest 1982.
That happened this past summer in Dallas. A Southwest Airlines jet had to change runways at Dallas-Fort Worth International after reports of a drone in the flight path. The FAA has released drone guidelines and voluntary registration for drones that weigh more than 55 pounds. But Representative Peter DeFazio, Democrat of Oregon and ranking member on the House of Representatives Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, says, if you're a flying reindeer, you're out of a job.
You're going to be dodging those drones. Hopefully Santa is not going to be delivering drones or delivering packages with drones, although, you know, that's probably not too far off in the future with some of our large commercial companies. That's the other side of this. We want to move ahead with the beneficial uses of the technology. I mean, for instance, we've had people interfere with forest firefighting, having to ground the firefighting aircraft because they were operating illegally to look at the fire and take photos. But actually, the firefighters themselves can use the drones and get them into areas to look for hot spots and things where we can't get aircraft. My wine growers, there's ways that they can tell, you know, the health of the grapes in the field and other parts of agriculture for irrigation or fertilization. There's tremendous commercial potential. So we've got to move ahead on the commercial track where things will be heavily regulated and licensed, but not to the point where we're going to, discourage the technology. At the same time, the more casual users have to be educated. They have to know the rules. They have to know they can't operate over 400 feet. They have to know they can't operate in critical airspace. They have to know they can't operate over sporting events or in public places like that. And we have to have at least put in place the beginnings of a system to track when people do violate and hopefully ultimately a system where we can find that person real time while they're operating.
How nervous do you get every time you see a picture of a public space depicted from a drone from the air that's posted on YouTube, like was the case for the Thanksgiving Day parade in New York City?
Well, there's certainly safety issues, you know, particularly as you get to heavier, larger drones that are being operated over crowded spaces. In many cases, these are at the moment illegal operations, so they aren't being done by licensed commercial operators. We're moving ahead with licensing commercial operators for certain functions and operations. But you know, one falling out of the sky, injuring someone, killing someone, that wouldn't be good. That's possible. So people need to know, what the risks are and what their restrictions are. And then even worse, one runs into a commercial aircraft. The FAA, I asked them, I said, okay, what happens when a jet engine ingests a drone? And they said, that's a good question. We've tested turkeys. We haven't done drones. So now at my request, they are plodding ahead with a test of ingestion of drones into turbine engines. And it, particularly with ones of any size, total failure, perhaps uncontained failure of a jet engine is very possible. Pilots have reported seeing these things at altitude on approach. Very dangerous.
Well, if a drone is on your holiday gift list, you've got some learning to do from the ranking member on the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, Representative Peter DeFazio, Democrat from Oregon. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, which has funded research that led to blood cancer treatments such as chemotherapy and stem cell transplants, and more recently, targeted therapies and immunotherapies to save thousands of lives. More at lls.org. Curious.com. Committed to helping people learn something new every day with more than 20,000 lessons on stock market tips, storytelling, shaken cocktails, and more. Learn more at curious.com/PRI. Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
Whoa.
Oh, stewardess, I speak jive.
You hear it in there. The Wookiees are coming. It's Friday when we talk about movies. Star Wars is almost here, but not quite yet. With me in the studio now, host of the Movie Date podcast, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. You two have been busy.
Oh, it's not over yet.
Yes, indeed. Let's start with The Krampus, which is kind of the fun movie of the weekend. First of all, let's hear a clip.
We can't go anywhere. It's too dangerous. You got it?
Howard, how much ammo do you have?
A couple shells still loaded, maybe a dozen in my pocket. Why?
I think our best bet is to stay put. Board up all the doors and windows, and as soon as the weather breaks, we'll go find her.
I told you we should have gone to my brother's.
Sure, Howard. Christmas on a pig farm.
Jesus was born in a barn.
This is a fun film about a Christmas fiasco, Rafer?
Well, it's a horror comedy, right? It's a family in a posh suburb. Little boy, played by MJ Anthony, believes in Santa Claus, but then gets mad and decides he doesn't believe in Santa Claus. And when he turns his back on Christmas, he unleashes the Krampus, which is kind of the anti-Claus. He comes not to give, but to take. And he starts picking off people one by one, which is a great premise, especially if you've, ever been trapped in a house with your extended family and you, have these fantasies about killing everybody. It's, there's some potential
here. No, you don't want to do that this week.
Well,
please,
come
Come on. I don't want to answer the emails, please. No fantasies about that. But if you do think about the other side of Christmas, that's what the Krampus is all about.
That's what it's trying to do. But I think as a horror film, it's not very scary. It's PG-13. It doesn't want to get sort of R and gory and bloody. But it is kind of creepy and weird, and it kind of raises the question of who this movie is trying to be for. It's too scary for anyone under 13.
Really?
It's not scary enough for anyone over 13. It feels very amateurish. David Kirchner is kind of good. We heard him there in the clip, but the movie is really a bit of a mess.
All right, let's move on to the letters. Both of you have seen this movie, which is a serious look at Mother Teresa's life.
We do not want you here. We do not need your help. We are Hindu. And do not teach our children about your God.
This is not a place for you, a Christian teacher. You don't belong here. It's best for you to go.
I may not be wanted here, but I am needed.
Mother Teresa, played by Kristen?
Juliet Stevenson. And in this film, we're mostly looking back at her life in the 1940s and 1950s, where she was a cloistered teacher and teaching very privileged girls. And she said, I want to leave the cloister. I want to go out into the world. I want to help the poor. This was a major fight that went all the way up with all the bishops until she was finally granted permission. And then we see her working among the poor. And here's the biggest problem with this movie. It's not something that you watch and think, wow, I understand why she's a saint, which I think is what they were trying to do with the movie. Because mostly what she's doing is being patient and waiting and kind.
Was there ever debate about why she was a saint? I mean, that would seem to be a fairly settled question, with the exception of Christopher Hitchens, who, of course, took her away. He doesn't appear in this movie.
No, he makes no cameo. I think the one thing this film tries to do, it's called The Letters, and it's based on her correspondence, which revealed something almost like a depression that she had for years and years, lots of dark moments, a lot of doubt about her faith and about her role in the world. That's kind of interesting. It's not something you think of when you think of Mother Teresa. But we never see that. We just hear people reading the letters and saying to us she had these feelings. And that doesn't really make a case to kind of flesh her out and make her like a worthwhile, an interesting figure, I think, to follow for the length of a biopic. I think we all know why Mother Teresa's a saint, and this film doesn't really tell us anything that new.
And if the theme is the only thing worse than being, there's nothing worse than being cloistered. And in fact, going into Calcutta is actually a huge sort of uplift from being cloistered back in the 1940s. We don't really get that from this film.
Yeah, and it's also just, it's not as epic as I want it to be. This isn't Gandhi. This isn't Selma. It's not a movie where you stand up and cheer. And in a lot of ways, it just feels that it should be on a PBS late night 1970s After Dark documentary slot.
Spike Lee has a holiday offering, Chirac, here.
Man, you really think something like that could bring peace?
Y'all know the power we have over them withholding just a day. A week.
Ooh.
Imagine a month. A year. Oh, they gonna bring the peace.
Suppose that the men just dump us.
If we all hold out, who can they go to?
What is this, Rafer?
Well, yeah, as you said, it's the new Spike Lee film. It's a couple things. It's based on, it's sort of a modern-day retelling of Lysistrata, the Greek play, in which the women held a sex strike to bring an end to the Peloponnesian War, which also worked somewhat in Liberia in the early 2000s. That woman who led that sex strike won a Nobel Prize for that. So you've got that. The dialogue rhymes, much like sort of in a Shakespearean way, but also a little
Aristophanes.
Bit of... Aristophanes. Yes, exactly. Kind of slam poetry in there as well.
Does it work?
It does not work. I think it's interesting. I think Spike Lee has a lot of stuff going on. It's very, very timely. I mean, it takes place in Chicago. It's all about gun violence and police shootings. It's really topical, really timely. It's a bit of a mess. It doesn't quite work as farce or tragedy, very preachy, as Spike Lee tends to get. But I still think he's a really interesting guy who's trying to engage with the world and make sense of it in that strange Spike Lee way that he has. And at moments, it's very interesting.
It's a good try. So these three gifts don't actually work for you for this weekend. But what holiday gifts do you guys remember loving, Rafer?
One of my favorites was a little build-your-own roller coaster with some little tracks and steel balls that you'd
nice.
Throw down that. And nice. I have to say, I actually got that when I was in high school.
Oh, that sounds so fun. Right.
That speaks to your nerdiness, yes?
Oh, there were so many gifts I loved. I'm wild about Christmas and have been since I was a kid. But one of my favorites was when I finally got that Light Bright with those chokeable little pieces that I was desperate for as a child. And I remember just spending hours with that Light Bright.
She still has it as at her desk, actually. Kristen Meinzer, takeaway. Culture producer and co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend, guys.
You too, John.
You too, John.
And we've been asking all of you what your favorite childhood gift is. My first bicycle was my favorite gift, although in less than a year I had my riding privileges revoked when my mother caught me riding double pedaling down a busy boulevard in Denver. I loved that bike.
This is Nick from Yorktown Heights, New York. And my favorite gift was a radio-controlled truck called the Super Blackfoot. It was supposed to be from Santa, but I discovered the present early by accident. My dad and I ended up building it together and having a lot of fun with it over the years, so it was always very special. I was also forever changed by that moment. I was 9 years old, and even today at 30, I still avoid spoiling surprises for myself or others as much as possible.
Beautiful story. Give us one at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, working to find cures for leukemia, lymphoma, Hodgkin's disease, and myeloma, improve the quality of life for patients and their families, and ensure access to treatments for patients. LLS.org.
Americans have an abiding affection for the British at their most British. Julian Fellowes is the soul behind the PBS hit Downton Abbey. He's also its sole writer for 6 seasons, and he wrote every one of Maggie Smith's lines in the show.
Why do we never see him?
Oh, Harold hates to leave America.
Curious. He hates to leave America. I should hate to go there.
But Fellowes not only went to America, he's managed to understand it better than most.
Piano man, front and center. You ever played keyboards?
No, I only play piano.
Okay, all right, fair enough. Try this out for me, okay? Just give this a try on my count, all right? 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. Yes.
Come on, come on, come on, come on, now touch me, babe. Ba-da-ba-da, can't you see that I am not afraid? Shaka-ka-ka.
He grasped, for instance, that this bit of Americana yearned to be an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical.
Stop. That's perfect.
Webber thought Julian Fellowes was perfect to write the book for Broadway's School of Rock musical based on the Jack Black hit movie. When I spoke to Fellowes before a live audience in the WNYC Green Space this week, he spoke a lot about America and how culturally it often tries to outdo the old empire. For instance, American formality, we often forget, he says, beats the British hands down in the old days.
America in the 1870s, 80s, 90s was very, very formal. I mean, they had more costumes for different activities than even the British. And they lived this extraordinary regulated formal life. I mean, like Newport, where they would build, you all know, the so-called cottages, which are vast houses. But unlike England, vast houses with no land. They would sit in right. 10 acres.
And tennis courts.
Huge houses with tennis courts and all the rest of it, but essentially no estate. But in those lives, I mean, they would go to Newport, in theory, for their sort of summer holiday, but that holiday you'd be in white tie every night at a banquet eating off gold plate with a footman standing behind your chair, far more than at that time in England. And so people, you know, the Duke of Marlborough, whatever, came out to marry Consuelo Vanderbilt, you know, the terrifying Alva Vanderbilt's daughter. And, I mean, he was absolutely amazed at the splendor of Newport. And he lived at Blenheim. I mean, so Americans now have this tremendous thing about informality. And they always say, oh, let's wear a tie. Don't let's wear a tie. You can take that off. Yeah. I mean, that's quite recent.
Right.
When I first came here, when I was 21, and that was in 1970, you always had to pack a dinner jacket because at least 3 or 4 things while you were here would be black tie. But now I'm not conscious of having put on a black tie in the last 15 or 20 years for anything except awards dinners, you know, Emmy night and that sort of thing. But never at a private dinner anymore. It probably means I'm moving in rather humble circles.
So, where are you in the hierarchy?
Of course, the British press has only basically got two pasts for you. Either you grow up in a palace with 27 servants,
right,
or you grow up under a sheet of corrugated iron somewhere on the M1. They don't really have anything in between that. But most people are in between that. And, I mean, I came, I suppose, from the sort of bottom of the top. We didn't have much money. My grandfather was a younger son. And what, in a way, gave me a sort of look at all this stuff, which I think I'm more aware of now. I don't think I was at all aware of it when I was younger. But my father came from one of those families, you know, a minor one, but I mean in the books. And my mother did not. My mother was the daughter of a civil servant and came from a perfectly respectable middle-class background.
But how dreadful for you to have to grow up and with your mother as the daughter of a civil servant.
I now know that my father's family couldn't stand her. And they thought she'd caught him. She was very, very good looking. And I don't know whether she caught him or not. I mean, they were very happy. What else matters? But my father's aunts and things would always sort of freeze when she came in. She wasn't part of the gang. She wasn't part of the club. And I think, to be honest, looking back, I think it caused a degree of unhappiness over the years. And my father was a diplomat, and then he went into Shell. And a lot of that involved being posted to Egypt, where I was born, to Kenya, where my brother was born, and then eventually my father was head of Shell in Nigeria. And for my mother, these postings were paradise, because she got out of it. She got away from the whole English game, and she could just be who she was. I mean, I loved my great-aunts, and one of them was the model for Violet Grantham and also for Maggie Smith's character in Gosford Park. You know, she was very tough, but she was hard. She was hard on my mother, and I know it.
Is Cora's story in Downton a bit of your mother's revenge in the sense that she's not in the book, but because she has American money, she can basically trump
No,
the
I wouldn't
slice.
Say that. Cora was a different thing. When you marry a foreigner and you agree to live in their country, a man or woman, you are going to have foreign children. You are going to have children of a different nationality to you, and they will have different prejudices and different assumptions. And I think it's quite testing that. I think it takes quite a large personality to be comfortable being a foreigner their whole life. I always admire it because I don't think I've got it. I came to England, I lived in America in the early 80s for a couple of years. I had a nice time, I lived on the West Coast, I got a certain amount of work, it was fun. But in the end, I felt I was always having to explain myself. Do you know what I mean? Explain, in the modern phrase, where I was coming from. And I just got tired of it. And in the end, I was getting more work in England, and I went back. And so it left me with a lasting admiration for people who do that and who make it work for them. And also, I wanted a character at the center of the story, or more than one, who could be in the middle of it, but critical of it. And not dyed in the wool. And by putting an American wife into the whole thing, I had a character who initially she kind of accepts it all and she sort of sucks it in, but every now and then she sticks up for her own values. But as the world changes and moves actually nearer the America of her own youth in the 1880s, she becomes more outspoken because she is more in tune with the changes that are happening than her husband is.
And so if there was some giant cricket match or softball game or, you know, soccer game between the cast members of Downton Abbey, and on one team was the staff, and on the other team were all the royals and heiresses and people in the book, what jersey would you wear?
No, I can't see myself as much of a Jersey man.
Come on, really. What team would you be on?
Which team would I be on? No, I'd be the umpire.
Julian Fellowes is the creator, writer, and executive producer of Downton Abbey, which is about to begin its final season. If you're dreading the end, not to worry. He has a TV show about America's first Gilded Age in the works. And in the meantime, you can catch his musical adaptation of School of Rock on Broadway. And here's something to take with you today. 3 weeks ago, gunmen killed 5 victims at Café Bon Beer in Paris. But today, patrons filled the tables lining the sidewalk café once again. It's the first of the Paris terrorist targets to reopen. Manager Audrey Billy told the BBC, quote, "We're going to start again to bounce back. We've carried out some work and repainted the walls to wipe away the signs of this nightmare." Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.